Hello, and welcome to episode 131 of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control, and on this episode, we bring you Lieutenant Commander Stefan Lundquist of the Swedish Defense University to talk about the Baltic Sea, its history, its geography, and the unique security challenges which result from it. This interview was conducted by Adrian Neumann, a research associate at Kiel University in Germany. We'll get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
Welcome to the newest SIMSEC podcast. My name is Adrian Neumann, and I'm Research Associate at the Center for Maritime Strategy and Security at the Institute for Security Policy at Kiel University in the beautiful north of Germany at the Baltic Seaport in Kiel. Today, I will be talking to Lieutenant Commander Stefan Lundquist. He's researcher at the Swedish Defense University in Stockholm. He joined us here at Kiel at the inaugural International Maritime Security Challenges Conference last year and presented the exciting research he has been doing at the Swedish Defense University on maritime security situation in the Baltic Sea region. He's on the phone now from Stockholm, and I want to talk with him about the Baltic Sea and the security situation we currently find here. Welcome, Stefan.
Good afternoon, Adrian. I appreciate the invitation from your organization to speak today. I am Stefan Lundquist, and I'm a lieutenant commander of the Royal Swedish Navy, and I'm currently assigned to the Swedish Defense University in Stockholm. I have served in the Navy since 1987 in various positions on board ships and in staffs at the tactical and operational levels of command. Since the late 1990s, I've been privileged to serve in staff appointments which have involved international relations. As a defense planner for the Swedish Armed Forces, I have benefited from working with representatives of other Swedish civilian agencies as well as UN representatives within the framework of multinational exercises. I am specialized in operations assessment and joint operations planning using the NATO Comprehensive Operations Planning Directive, which I teach at the Swedish Defense University. I would like to stress that the views I express here today are entirely my own and not those of the Swedish Armed Forces or the Swedish Defense University.
Wonderful, Stefan. Thank you very much. I think we can see you have got lots of experience under your belt. So all my questions should just be a walk in the park for you.
Let's see.
Well, if we look back, you know, until 1990, probably maritime security in the Baltic Sea comprised West and East German fast patrol boats chasing each other. And the Swedish Navy was busy hunting Russian subs. But after 1990, the concept of maritime security has changed a lot in the Baltic Sea, which, at least from our perspective, it became then a sea of peace. We had economic development, and everybody was more talking about maritime safety. You know, the mine hunting vessels were used to mostly clear UXOs from the Second World War. The wharves closed down or started building yachts for billionaires. We saw growing shipping, wind parks being built, growth in tourism, more offshore exploitation, lots of operations on the seabed, laying gas pipelines, power and communication cables. So if we look at this back in retrospect and where we're standing today, I feel that today it appears that the traditional interpretation of maritime security is somehow back in the Baltic Sea. We know from different reports of frequent border infringements and harassment in the airspace and of vessels within the EEZ, as well as expanding Russian submarine operations. How does this situation represent itself when you look at it from Stockholm? And when do you feel that kind of shift from maritime safety back again, if you agree with me, to really maritime security has happened?
Well, Adrian, I think that most analysts and policymakers consider the more assertive policy line presented by Vladimir Putin in his address at the 43rd Munich Conference on Security Policy to be merely words. Today, we see it in a different light. The shift, it did not happen overnight, I think, but it developed exponentially and became clear somewhere around 2013. On a daily basis, we see the result of Russia's deliberate strategy to increase its military capabilities and to oppose any further encroachment by the West into what it perceives as their zone of interest. Unfortunately, the Baltic states, Finland, Poland and Sweden, are part of this zone in which Russia wants to have a larger stake than these weaker states are allowed to. Although the geostrategic conditions differ, Russia's naval behavior shares some features with the way China seeks to safeguard its interest in the South China Sea. I think that both use hybrid strategies in which weaker states' dependency are unrestrainedly availed in their pursuit of regional power and influence. I think that both pursue anti-access, area denial strategies to fend off any US involvement in what they consider their maritime domain. I think also that both interfere with lawful maritime activities of its neighbors. I also think that both want to have a larger say than the weaker states in the way the resources of a maritime domain are distributed and used. I also think that both consider the national jurisdiction applicable in the EEZs. And finally, I think that both use the language of power, claiming the right of the fittest and aspire to be regional suzerains. What is worrying is that the result of it is a bullying behavior in which a combination of psychological operations, cyber operations, threatening maneuvers by military aircraft and naval vessels are projected towards the counterparts of the neighboring states. All this is mixed with an increasing level of intrusions of their territorial waters and airspace. In Finland and Sweden, we have suffered from repeated cyber attacks for the latest months. In Finland, a distributed denial-of-service attack was launched hours before Finnish President Sauli Niinistö met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow on 22nd March. They were about to discuss regional security issues and the implementation of deeper cooperation on border defense. On February 22nd, key government department websites, including finance, social affairs and health, agriculture and forestry, and the Council of State office, were targeted in simultaneous attacks. In February, also this year, Swedish Supreme Commander Mikael Bodin informed that Russia exposes Sweden to cyber attacks and information operations on a daily basis. On 19 March, a distributed denial-of-service attack shut down Swedish government sites and all major media. Last month, Swedish authorities revealed that it was a cyber attack on Sweden's air traffic control infrastructure that grounded civilian flights on 4 November last year, not a solar storm, which was initially reported. This has awakened the politicians, and on 22nd April, Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström informed that Sweden will join the NATO Stratcom Center in Riga and thereby increase its information operations capabilities. If we turn to the maritime domain, civilian activities such as maritime service and cable laying work have been repeatedly interfered with and harassed by vessels and aircraft of the Russian Baltic Fleet and the Russian Air Force. The Russian practice to fly with their transponders off on the reconnaissance aircraft creates safety hazards. Since March 2013, Russia has regularly scheduled simulated air attacks against Sweden, testing the alert status of the Swedish Air Force. In October 2014, Sweden launched a week-long search operation for what has widely been assumed to be a Russian submarine in the archipelago of Stockholm. Also, US vessels and aircraft now get the same reception in the Baltic Sea. It's not a warm reception, it's a cold one. In 12 and 13 of April, two Sukhoi 24 strike fighters and a military helicopter made repeated close encounters with the USS Donald Cook, conducting naval exercises with a Polish military helicopter in the Baltic Sea on international water. On 14 April, Sukhoi 27 barrel rolled over a US RC-135 reconnaissance plane in international airspace over the Baltic Sea. We appreciate, from a Swedish perspective, that these incidents did not prevent the USS Donald Cook and the US Navy P3 Orion from making an underway anti-submarine warfare engagement with the Swedish Navy on 22nd of April. Thank you.
So, the Baltic Sea seems to be very much busy right now from all the examples you give, and we realize that activities, while I actually wanted to talk with you about the maritime domain, you explained to me that this is a multi-domain conflict, if we may call it a conflict. But for the moment, I would love to go back sort of in the Baltic Sea itself. What are sort of the specific areas in the Baltic Sea that people who are not familiar with it should know about? Which are the ones that sort of had geostrategic importance currently inside the Baltic Sea?
I would say that first entrance to the Baltic Sea, which is one of the world's largest inland seas with brackish water by surface area, it is limited by the gateways of a narrow Öresund Strait and the Bell Sea area. This shallow and narrow connection is particularly sensitive to disturbances. When it comes to the Baltic proper, it is bordered on its northern edge, at the latitude of 60 degrees north, by the Åland Islands and the Gulf of Botnia. On its northeastern edge, by the Gulf of Finland. On its eastern edge, by the Gulf of Riga. And in the west, by the South Swedish part of the Scandinavian Peninsula. Second, the Gulf of Finland is of critical importance to Finland as well as to Russia, since it hosts the Kronstadt Naval Base located on Kotlin Island, some 30 kilometers west of St. Petersburg, as well as two naval bases of the Finnish Navy, and they are located in Åpenäs, or in Finnish Upinjemi, and Åbo, which in Finnish is Turku. Also, it is the umbilical cord of much of the trade of both countries. Both Russia and Finland are very, very dependent on this sea trade. Third, the demilitarized Åland archipelago, rightly held by Napoleon at the days he was around weaving his power, to be the forefront of Stockholm. It is a military strategic key, also to the key of Gulf of Botnia. And there is actually a geostrategic old saying that whoever controls Åland may isolate the entire Gulf of Botnia, and it stands also today.
Speaking about the interoperability and C2, so if already, of course, it's challenging to do this with one partner and to decide, you know, what is possible in peacetime, how does it roll out concerning cooperation now with multinational organizations? I imagine the European Union has a role to play, obviously, since this conflict is sort of, let's call it, comprehensive, NATO, as well as other Baltic stakeholders. How does that work? What other cooperations are there in place where Sweden is sort of taking a role?
Yeah, I would say a key mechanism that has been thought through, if Sweden and Finland would have started up a dialogue, is the Swedish way of doing business better than the Finnish way of doing business. Well, I think they would have struggled. Now, the Swedish-Finnish cooperation is fully based on NATO standard, so they are pursuing deepening naval cooperation, but it is based on NATO standards. So instead of discussing whether Sweden's or Finland's procedures are the best, they go for NATO procedures. And since they go for NATO procedures, that's also what goes in most European countries. And that means that when Sweden and Finland are increasing their interoperability, they also increase the interoperability with the other partners. And of course, then if Germany takes the lead in the northern coast, that it's all this cooperation becomes a part. It's part of the Nordefco. It's based on the Nordefco cooperation, Nordic Defense Cooperation, with the agreements on defense cooperation inside this framework. And also then it's just a link on to whatever EU or NATO, whatever political flag you are assigned to this. It will be interoperability. Should not be a problem in due time. But as of today, I would say the US Navy plays a key role in fostering interoperability with its allies and partners. I would say that it is best illustrated by the US Baltics exercise series. But I also think that there is plenty of room for a more ambitious presence of both the US Navy and the US Coast Guard in the Baltic Sea, definitely.
All right. One thing that always comes up is Kaliningrad. I mean, we spoke a lot about history of the different countries in the region and the different nations, and obviously Kaliningrad at some point was German. So there, you know, the history is a bit different. So we see the remilitarization of Kaliningrad. We see the Russian state armament program reinvigorating the Baltic fleet. From your perspective, what role does Kaliningrad play? Is this kind of, let's say, an asset for Russia to understand as sort of being forward deployed, or rounding up the Baltic states, or is this rather a liability as being basically exposed and sometimes talking about as a potential pawn?
I think these are very good questions, Adrian. To my understanding, that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I would say that Kaliningrad was perceived by many as the black hole of Europe. But then Vladimir Putin came to power, I would say that the outlook improved, mainly due to the steady economic growth the president was able to deliver. Thanks to its unique situation as a Russian exclave or an EU enclave, it was hoped that Kaliningrad could boost dialogue between Russia and the EU. And I think many people adhere to this positive, to have this like an example. This is a way to engage with Russia, to make Russia more European, and maybe also go for this, that economic improvement would then benefit Russia, and then we would have the democratic Russia, and perhaps also that it would sooner or later start to adopt the European values. But I would say that these hopes, they have been dashed, and they are not even close to adopting any European values. Instead, I would say that we shouldn't go back to the Cold War to understand Russia. Now, we should go back even further back to understand Russia than from the Cold War setting. To Kaliningrad, the situation, as you mentioned, it was once East Prussia. So I think when we are considering Åland very important to Sweden, and we of course, when we engage with Finland, we also realize the history, and then we do remember, and we have strong links with each other. I understand that it is with Germany and Kaliningrad. But I would say that Kaliningrad has always been characterized by a strategic value, and it's the port, it's very important, it's a nice free port. But Kaliningrad, it appears now to be too doomed to replay its Soviet role as a Russian fortress in Europe. And the way I understand the Russian view, Kaliningrad is unique and must be provided for in terms of security because it's encircled by Western countries. And in terms of its economy, as successful economic development is made much more difficult due to this encirclement, then so Russia must care for this. And in fact, Russia is pouring troops and weapons, including missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads, into its Western exclave at such a rate that the region is now one of Europe's most militarized places. So, yes, I would say that we are going back here. But also that the size of Russia's military exercises in the district of Kaliningrad, bordering Lithuania, has raised great concerns in this country. And from Sweden, from Stockholm, when we look at this, our is centered on the anti-exercise area denial capacities that Russia are able to project from its enclave, and the continuing build-up of its Baltic Sea Fleet for the 2020 armament program. I don't know if you follow it, but in April this year, they rolled back the special economic zone status that the exclave had.
Yes.
And that meant that local producers lost the right to duty-free imports and export to and from members of the EU. Where I have read it is that Russian minister has been quite blunt about the economic failure of Kaliningrad. It is marked by very low levels of productivity. Compared to Germany, it's 5 to 20% only. A distinct lack of qualified labor resources and a lack of foreign direct investment in the local economy. So the Kremlin recently promised to allocate an additional 66 billion rubles to compensate for the loss of this special economic zone status. So taken together, I think that Kaliningrad is an asset, and it's also a burden to Russia. And I have a fear. My fear is that these factors might prove to be destabilizing in the midterm perspective. I'm afraid that Russia, if it continues to bleed economically, but still be able to have its military capability and capacity, it might perceive of itself as trapped in a corner with few strategic options, and that could be worrying.
Indeed. I know some people suggested when the Ukraine conflict started, you know, Kaliningrad was very suddenly, you know, seen as something exposed in the West as the enclave, whether or not to use soft power and offer European Union passports to everybody there. But I think it has never been tried. Well, no. We'll watch it.
It's the EU way to do a soft approach. And
yeah.
I would say that you could use the old American saying that you should speak softly but carry a big stick. And I think that we should understand that dealing with Russia, we also need to be powerful. You should never be weak, but when you are powerful, you also should not escalate things and you shouldn't provoke. So you should always keep an open hand for Russia as well, for cooperating. But I think it's very important not to be weak with Russia. And it's very important that we also make clear that what are our interests and what are limitations and what is the must do from our perspective to cooperate. But I think that's important.
Yes, I mean, I think we both know that the Baltic Sea or the unhindered sea transport is critical to Russia, as well as you know, for example, to Sweden to get all their goods. So it's kind of interesting to see, because nobody has an interest to escalate in that kind of area into anything.
No, and I think that needs to be the way we should work. We must work together with Russia. But Russia should not set the terms for the cooperation. We should set the terms of the cooperation, and we need to be strong. And when we are strong and when we set the rules of the cooperation, then we should also invite Russia, because Russia has their interest, and we have no reason at all to deny them the interests that are theirs. So we should not by any means provoke Russia, or we should be open, but we should also be very clear with the terms for cooperating.
One thing we have not touched upon really properly is the topic of energy, which we know energy has become sort of a strategic topic for Europe. And there is the big debate about whether or not it's good to have a pipeline going through the Baltic Sea and a second one going around Ukraine, going around Poland, to supply then Germany and from then, if needed, the rest of Europe with gas. What is the Nord Stream, is the name, and now Nord Stream 2. What is the latest status, and what do you feel, what role does that play in the whole Baltic Sea theater?
Yes, since Russia, in the Cold War setting, the Cold War, in my opinion, was about ideology. It was communism versus capitalism, and it was East against West. And I don't think that's no longer part of the calculus. I would say instead that interests are at the heart of today's security challenges in the Baltic Sea, as it is elsewhere on our globe. I think it's about who gets what and when. It's about control and it's about power. Here in the Cold War, the military tool of power was almost always at the forefront, but it's not the case today. And it's not the same scenario as the Cold War. So instead, it's all the other things that are in the front line. At the forefront, it could be dependencies. And of course, the Nord Stream, if we already have it, and Germany is, of course, have a dependency on gas as much of Europe. And when Europe is dependent on natural gas from Russia, we have a dependency. And that is, of course, something that Russia could use and exploit to say that we, as a bargaining chip. Also, over the Baltic states, they are trying to, they have opened these new ports to get Norwegian gas with tankers to get it in through Klaipeda. I would say that, of course, it's a little bit worrying if we are increasing our dependency on whatever with Russia, because it will probably use it one way or another, maybe not now, but maybe in the future. So I would say it's a little bit worrying that we still have these dependencies with Russia. And now I would say that Russia is actually the actor that's promoting maritime insecurity, since Russia is using its navy to interfere with whatever lawful activities that the coastal states are pursuing. If there is surveys for research, for environmental research, if it is cable line work or whatever, Russia is in, and they are harassing and they are disturbing and we are creating hazards. We should actually not accept this, and we shouldn't accept that Russia considers that in its EEZ, it doesn't have to regard international law, but it thinks its domestic law is applicable in EEZ. So I think that we have a challenge, and I think also that we need to start pursuing this comprehensive approach, and that goes inside our countries, and for Sweden, this is there are numerous challenges in integrating the Swedish Coast Guard with the Swedish Navy and working together, but we are working on it. But of course it also gets bigger if you're going to work then collaboratively, jointly with other states, but I think that's exactly what we need to start doing, to find ways of working together to jointly promote maritime security. And while we do it at the law enforcement level, we should of course train for the upper level of the threat spectrum to operate with our naval ships in the high level spectrum of threats.
Well, of course, I have to ask now, well, wouldn't it be a great framework to do this from inside NATO?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I think that US is very, very important here. And NATO as an organization was accepted for security guarantees from the US to Europe. And I think that is still very valid for the organization. But I think that the US could actually help the states of Europe here to be active and take an active part in these kind of missions. So yes, I think NATO is a very, very suitable framework for this.
And referring to Sweden and Finland, you said you suggested the Americans should come in and we could cooperate, and the Swedish Coast Guard, Swedish Navy, they cooperate. But currently, Sweden and Finland are not part of NATO, obviously.
No, that's true, but there are certain frameworks we are. Both Finland and Sweden are active NATO partners, and actually we have this gold card program that we are pursuing, and also recently here Sweden revised its military strategy doctrine to include a framework under which the defense of Sweden can be conducted either alone or if needed in collaboration with multinational Nordic, European Union or NATO forces. And this new doctrine, it shifts the emphasis of national defense from a post-Cold War era strategy largely based on containment to a more aggressive model that will deploy advanced weapons systems and modern warfare forces as part of a sustained and coordinated high-impact strike against attackers. And this is quite a unique change in Sweden. We also have, actually, except for the Swedish-Finland cooperation, the government of Sweden mandated its armed forces to negate bilateral agreements with relevant authorities. Also in Denmark, to allow for the use of each other's ports for alternative basing of naval units in peacetime. Swedish Defense Minister Peter Hultqvist and his Danish colleague Peter Christiansen signed a memorandum of understanding between Sweden and Denmark on enhanced defense cooperation, including such an agreement on 14 January this year. Also in September last year, Sweden signed a much-noted defense cooperation agreement with Poland. So I would say that we are non-aligned, we are not a member of NATO, but we are very active partners, and we are ready to do what is needed, actually, to ensure the safety of our country, the sovereignty of our country, and to promote the interests of our country together with the other coastal states of the region, and with NATO, and with US.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm persuaded. I tried to trick you before to get a political statement from you on the perspective on joining NATO, yes or no, because I know that is something that is debated, obviously, in Sweden and in Finland as a reaction to the Russian actions of the past years. But what I'm before interested in is, to me, it seems a bit surprising always that we would call for the United States to come all the way across the Atlantic to bring their coast guard to take care of a sea that is confined, and that somehow the people who should have really the key interests in securing it do not have the ability or the political will to undertake or set up a European Coast Guard and the like by themselves. And that is interesting, that since I see there are already sort of the islands of cooperation, And you just told us before that the individual bilateral agreements you have with Finland, with Denmark, and the like. Do you see there, I know there are different activities also driven and supported by EU maritime strategy on maritime domain awareness, which I think is a key factor, of course. You need to know what's going on in order to be able to do anything. There is this ZUKBAS and MARSUR. Can you probably talk about these kind of things, about shared domain awareness and what initiatives?
I would be happy to do that, Adrian. Yeah. But I'm not saying that the US should come here to take care of the security of the Baltic Sea. I just think that we need the leadership of the US, because it also comes down to the security guarantees of the Baltic states, and it comes down to Russia, and it's come down to capabilities. And some of these capabilities that we need to bring along is actually, it's a US capability. They are actually providing these capabilities also into NATO. So it doesn't have to take very many vessels of the US Coast Guard, and not very many vessels at all by the Navy. It's just that we should then, of course, under the banner of this, to coordinate and lead this kind of, I think we should all make significant contributions from Germany, from Denmark, from Sweden, from Poland, from Finland. Of course we have to do that, and also from the Baltic states with their resources. But I think that we could benefit from US leadership making actually what they are doing in the South China Sea. I think it's a very good model, and it doesn't have to take that awful lot of resources of the US to do. So, and I turn you on to the maritime domain awareness. I would say that having a shared maritime domain awareness constitutes a baseline for, it's the baseline for providing maritime security. If you don't know what's happening, you don't know what you should do and react to or act about. And accordingly, Sweden and Finland operate the bilateral sea surveillance cooperation, Finland and Sweden's interface for exchanging target information in the northern Baltic Sea between an autonomous maritime surveillance system. And this SACFIS system was established in 2006, and it actually enables us to exchange secret target data between the nations. And it works excellent. Finland and Sweden have taken on lead roles in the wider Unclassified Sea Surveillance Cooperation Baltic States. This is a SACBAS system. It's a wider, and the EU Maritime Surveillance Cooperation. And here, quite tellingly, Russia was invited to join the SACBAS Cooperation, but they consistently refused to participate. Nevertheless, the geographical scope of this SACBAS Cooperation has grown to include the Baltic Sea's approaches by the UK becoming a fully-fledged member in March last year. So I think this is very interesting. What is actually more disturbing to Russia here is not that we cooperate regionally on maritime domain awareness, although they are not inside this. It's still open for them, so nothing is closed. It is a Swedish pending implementation of its host nation support agreement with NATO this month. A recent report by the Swedish Security Service revealed, not just the other week here, that Russian agents have actively sought to counteract a pending implementation of this agreement by spreading consistent misinformation. And this agreement was signed in 2014 and has been met with tribute as well as criticism in Sweden. But it will now very soon be submitted to Parliament for debate and decision on its implementation. And regardless of view of the issue, I think that very important here that we should not let Russia influence our national decision-making or foreign and security policy, neither by threats nor by subversion. And I think this is something that upsets Russians more. So our maritime domain awareness cooperation is a good baseline for everyone.
May your words be heard. So probably to round it up, it appears to me a bit kind of, let's say, schizophrenic, the way Russia is dealing in this kind of theater. So on the one side they say, well, you know, please Finland, please Sweden, don't get closer to NATO. And on the other side, with the same kind of actions, with harassment and the like, you would feel that they're driving you into NATO's arms.
That's a politically sensitive question, Adrian. I'll try to
get a tiptoe around it.
Okay. But I don't consider Russians as schizophrenic. Not at all.
Not the people, of course not. Strategy.
The Russian way. I think it's the Russian way is, that's the old way and that's the hard way. If you know your history, we all know how it used to be before the Cold War, before ideology came in. And if you go to the people of Finland, they actually suffered quite badly. 1899 and 1905 was a time of oppression when they should, you know, justify this province that they had conquered. Also, before the breakout of the First World War, they had this Russification attempt on the Finnish population. And I think that the peoples of Finland and Sweden do not take Russian threats and aggressive behavior easy, because we haven't forgotten our history, and especially not in Finland. And it's not that many years since they got free from this friendship, cooperation and mutual assistance agreement. And although Finland and Sweden are small powers, and although we have a limited capacity, I think Finland and Sweden will not accept Russia wielding its power to the detriment of their nations. And I think that they will fight for the right. But I also think that your assessment is correct, Adrian. There is a momentum in the changing preferences among the Finns and the Swedes. And as the Russian threats increase, so does the popular support for NATO membership. And I think that this causal relationship is not spurious. And last week, the result of a major 2015 opinion poll was released. And it stated that for the first time, when the supporters of the Swedish application for NATO membership outnumber the opponents, 38% of the respondents were favorable to a Swedish application for NATO membership as compared to 31% in 2014. And on the other hand, the respondents who considered it a bad idea was reduced to 35% as compared to 37% in 2014. And if nothing else, I would say that this result indicates a greater interest for security policy among the population of non-aligned Sweden. And that is, of course, warmly welcomed. When to try to make a prediction is that if they join, I'm quite convinced that Finland and Sweden will do it jointly. Because I think that during the process, if any of these countries would apply for membership, they would have a harsh time with Russia during this process, when Russia would not spare any resource on actually convincing the state to withdraw its application. But for applying, I would say in Sweden, I think it's not likely to happen before the next governmental election, if it happens. Notwithstanding this, I'm sure that the armed forces of the two countries, spearheaded by the navies, will continue their quest for interoperability with each other and with NATO, no matter the outcome of the political process. I think that's important for actually the practical aspects of cooperating, that the navies are there and they are interoperable. And also, although we are not members or not members, we are able to cooperate. And I think that the Swedish revised strategy, the military strategic doctrine, also is very clear on this, that's the way we see that it will happen.
Wonderful. I think that's a very good ending. We brought it back from the political level onto the surface. Well, Stefan, thank you very much. It was great talking to you. Thank you for your time. And all the best. And talk to you soon.
Thank you, Adrian. Thanks for allowing me the opportunity to speak to you.
That concludes episode 131 of Sea Control from the Center for International Maritime Security. A very special thank you to our TILS producers, Roman Madaus and Ryan Yulia. And if you enjoyed this episode and aren't already subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes immediately as they become available. And if you really like us, go on to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time on Sea Control.